Good Saturday morning to everybody, and welcome to the Catholic Cemeteries Association radio show, along with Chris Radlitz, the Director of Family Services over at the CCA. I am Gary Byron. Chris, good morning, bro. How you been?
Hey, very well, thank you, Gary. Looking, life is good. How about with you?
Looking good. Yeah, it's a Memorial Day weekend. Here we are in the radio station. But I've got to tell you, I mean, listen, this is like the unofficial beginning of summer.
It
takes you from Memorial Day week and to Labor Day weekend. It's the summer.
Heck, well,
season.
I remember already, what was it, a little week and a half ago, where almost 2 weeks ago, where the weather was already in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
it was
yeah.
So nice. And no humidity, low humidity.
That's the beauty of this time
I
of
love.
Year.
Yeah.
When you get hot weather where there's no humidity yet.
I know. It's the humidity that ruins it always.
Oh, man. Do you have any plans this weekend?
Well, you know what? It's a busy weekend for us at the cemetery because people will be coming in to lay flags at the veterans' graves and all those people that served and lost their lives in different conflicts fighting for our country. So for us, it's a very solemn time, but it's also a great time of joy for being able to recognize continuously the sacrifice that these people had made for us and for our freedoms. So it's a very nice thing. And if you come to our cemeteries during that time, you don't have a flag, but you want one, you just come to the office and we'll give you one that you can put, you know, on grave.
That's really nice.
Of a loved one or a service member that you know gave the ultimate sacrifice.
I was talking with a Cub Scout, talking about the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I know they're both military. I said, yeah, that's true, you know. But he wasn't. Were they the kind of the same? And I said, well, no. But they have something in common. And you're right. It does have something to do with the military. I said, but Veterans Day are for those living veterans who.
Well, it's for anyone. Anyone that was a veteran.
Sure. But Memorial Day is when we memorialize those
Memorial
who made the ultimate sacrifice.
Memorial Day is honoring those that have given their lives in service of their country.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the big difference.
You mentioned something about how the cemeteries are actually quite active this weekend due to the flags and the planting of those little American flags that they plant at grave sites. What's the protocol when it comes to that? Do you supply it? Who picks
generally
it up
people,
when you
no,
gotta cut the grass?
Generally, people will bring their own flags,
okay.
You know, and they'll place them. Usually before Memorial Day, we will ourselves replace tattered flags because we don't like American flags to be in disrepair.
Okay.
It's not a sign of respect towards something that represents our country. So it's usually during Memorial Day that if the flags haven't been replaced by loved ones, we'll go out and actually replace some of them ourselves because we don't want to see tattered flags flying on graves. But you'd be surprised. There's so many people that come and bring flags. And if they don't, like I said, they can come into the office and we'll have one.
And it's okay for them to plant them there, obviously.
Absolutely.
How long do they traditionally stay?
Forever. We don't touch them.
Oh.
We don't touch American flags. You put an American flag on a grave, it's staying there. We'll mow around it. We'll do whatever we have to.
Okay.
No, it's a,
I like that. That's,
it's a huge honor. It's a huge honor to have those who gave their lives working in our cemeteries.
Do you ever get people who bring like candles or stuffed animals?
Oh, my gosh, if you would see some of the things. Yes. And you know what? I think it's a beautiful expression of a family's love and care for the person that's passed. So to me, I totally get it. Here's the reality. If we allowed everybody to do that, the place would look like a, you know.
Carnival?
It would not have the solemn, reverential feeling that you have. You know, you can't have balloons strung up everywhere. You can't have all this stuff.
Balloons?
Oh, yeah. People come in, tie balloons to the top of their monuments.
What?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I don't get that.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, and you'll see it. And, you know, it's, no, we can't. Because when you come in, the main thing you have to understand is that you're here to pay respects to those who have passed. And in order to pay respects, you want to come to a place that is reverent, that cares about how you, as a family member, are coming to visit those that you lost. So we were trying to make it. Now, I think it's absolutely wonderful when I come in to work in the morning and I'll drive. And I like to usually take a drive through the cemetery that my office is in just to see how things look, et cetera, you know. And there's this handful of graves that I always go by, and sure enough, the weekend was there, and, you know, they've got an empty bottle of Corona.
Oh,
and, oh. Yeah.
I wasn't thinking of that. Empty bottle of Corona.
There's an empty bottle of Corona. There's a newspaper. And it's all lined up very neatly, you know, right on a monument, leaning against it. And then we leave it there for a day or two, and then we pick it all up because you can't have that stuff there. But so, yeah, there's all kinds of things. Beautiful rosaries that people come and they lay over the tops of the monuments.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Some things that are just absolutely wonderful. But to me, I love to see any expression by a family of the care and concern and the remembrance of the person that has passed that was important to them in life. And it's good to know that they're still so important to them in death. Because obviously, as Catholics, you know, one of the things that we're supposed to do as part of the corporal works of mercy is pray for the dead. What better way to come and honor them and say a few prayers when you visit their grave?
Well stated. I know that we've, my goodness, I think we spent a few shows talking about the lives of just really ordinary people living extraordinary lives.
Yeah, I think we call them saints.
That's right. Maybe we should look at some individuals in the history of the church that have achieved a status that only a few have really achieved. Let's, for example, the doctor of the church. I don't know what is the doctor of the Catholic Church? And I guess the immediate follow-up would be, how many are there today?
Well, I can't tell you the last time that an individual was named doctor of the church, but within the Catholic faith, there are 36 doctors of the church. Okay, and they hail from all different ages throughout the church's history. Of those 36, four are women. And we can talk more about each one specifically if you'd like. But in general, the title Doctor of the Church is an official designation that's bestowed by the Pope in recognition of an outstanding contribution a person has made to understanding and interpretation of sacred scripture and the development of our Catholic doctrine and faith. Okay? It's based on three requirements. The first is that the individual has holiness that is truly outstanding, even among saints. So someone that is truly, truly a holy individual. Second, has to have the depth of doctrinal insight. So in other words, this person not only has to know what the doctrine is of the church, but understand what is the philosophical meaning behind it. What is the real theological meaning behind it? And being able to express it. Mm. And the third, in terms when we talk about expression, is an extensive body of writings that the church can recommend as an expression of the authentic, life-giving Catholic tradition. So those three things, if there's an individual that meets all three of those criteria, then they can be nominated as a doctor of the church. And to be honest with you, I don't even know what the process is, because it's been a long time since anyone has been made a doctor of the church.
How long? Approximately?
Oh, I don't know.
Hundreds of years. Or, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a lot to it. So doctor of the church is a person whose teaching on faith has been deemed of sound doctrine and of benefit to the church through their writing, study, or research. There's a significant theological contribution that that person has and has given to the understanding of our faith. To anyone that is involved in reading what they've written, that person, again, has to have a high degree of sanctity, and that's why all church doctors are canonized saints.
I'm curious, though, to why there are four women.
Why wouldn't there be? What a sexist comment. No.
Because there's how many, you said? I mean,
four. There's 36 total 36. Doctors of the church, four of which are women.
Where, was I going to ask this? Was there a time when women could not be?
No.
Oh.
No, that was never the case.
Okay.
It's purely based on the things that I just talked about, those three criteria. So women of the if you are a saint, if you're canonized a saint, mm-hmm. and you also happen to fall into all the categories listed, okay. then I guess your name is brought up and the Pope can designate you a doctor of the church.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, it's really... You talk about having, you know, being non-gender specific in terms of how we, you know, view this beautiful recognition that's given to individuals. It doesn't matter if you're man or woman. It depends on your body of writing and your understanding of, you know, the faith and how you've affected
yeah,
other people
no quota.
In your life.
Yeah.
No, there's no quota. Absolutely not.
Well, you mentioned saints, so I have a question about that. What I'd like to do maybe is maybe examine some of the more prominent saints. Let's go in chronological order. So we'll start with St. Augustine.
St. Augustine. Well, okay. St. St. Augustine was a very, very interesting guy. As a young man, he would be what we would now refer to as a cad.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. He was, all right, so I mean, he was raised in a family that was very, very Catholic. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take very long for him to like drift away from that, okay? And he basically totally enjoined himself to a dissolute life of revelry, of sin, and anything you could possibly imagine, this guy was into it, okay? So he was a real cat. But interestingly enough, one of the things that he said in his writings was that he always kept in the recess of his heart that there's a divine nature somewhere out there. He never forgot about God and God's existence, but he certainly didn't care about it in his daily, you know, debauchery, of which there was a significant
amount.
There's
a lot of people who live their life like that now, even.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So anyway, he was born back in like 354. I mean, in what is today known as Algeria. And he has turned into one of the most significant and influential thinkers in the history of the Catholic Church. And a lot of his teachings are foundation for Christian doctrine for thousands of years, okay? He is an extremely deeply philosophical guy. And if you follow his career, he studied in Carthage, and which was at that time a well-known city. He was a very brilliant man. He was an orator, and he was actually studying at one time to be a lawyer. And he fell in love with philosophy. When he was studying, he fell in love with philosophy. And in doing so, he pursued philosophy with a great vengeance. One of the interesting things that happened in his life, because he ran into a saint. He wasn't a saint back then. But he went to Rome and then Milan. And in 386, he met St. Ambrose in Milan, who at the time was a bishop and the doctor of the church.
Oh.
Yeah. His sermons inspired St. Augustine to look for the truth. He had always sought in the faith that he had rejected from early days. He was now being inspired to seek the truth. Because he was attracted to this group that at the time was called the Manichaeans, okay? And this is a group that actually at one time was growing just as fast as the Catholic Church was, believe it or not. In the early 400s and 500s, it was a very vastly growing religious movement. And basically what it was, it was just this offshoot of a combination of Catholicism, Buddhism, Hinduism, all put together, and it was this dualist cosmology. So what it basically said was, there's a force for good, and there's a force for evil, and they got to work together, and they got to balance each other out, okay? Everything was dualist. So whether there was good, there was bad. If there was a God, there was a devil. If there was, you know, this, then there was that.
A yin and yang,
up and down, that's how it all was. Mm-hmm. And we as individuals lived our life understanding that we were involved in this cosmological duality that we would have to face every day of our lives. And that's how it was. And, you know, anyway, that's why it was very popular.
Okay.
It was very popular because people, just like today, you know, we can understand. It's very dualist. So there's a good, there's a bad. There's no gray.
No, I get you.
It's this way, this or that way.
Right.
Well, people like that. It's simple.
It's black or white.
It's black or white.
Yeah.
Well, back in the day, it gave the Catholic Church a run for its money in terms of its teaching because it believed in the teachings of Jesus. It also believed in the teachings of Socrates. It also believed in the teachings of
Moses.
Not Moses. Abraham.
Okay.
You know, all these different faith teachings, they believed in all of them. And it said that what they could do was categorize everything into these different buckets. So you had a bucket on one side and you had a bucket on the other. Again, the dualist philosophy. This one's here, this one's here. And you pick and choose which one you want to follow. So this appealed to him because they convinced him, the leaders of these groups convinced Augustine that they had the answers to the mystery of nature, that they could disprove all of scriptural writing. They could explain the problem of evil to him because to them it was very simple. So he actually was a follower of them for almost 9 years. And he learned as much as he could about it until he ultimately rejected it as being completely incoherent and fraudulent, which, of course, it was. And eventually that's why it fell apart and you never even heard of it. 99.9% of the people in this country have never heard of that before. Okay. Uh-huh. Yet it was a vital part of his life. So anyway, I bring all that up because it was shortly right after that he met St. Ambrose. And that's when he started to hear his sermons, and that's what caused him to really go out and start to search for the truth. He then received baptism soon after hearing some of these sermons. Because even though he was raised in a Catholic family, back then they didn't baptize you as a baby. You were baptized in the middle teen years as an adult.
Oh, okay? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, it's only in our days, it's in modern history, that we baptize babies. People were baptized much older. Okay, because if you think about it, oh, man, can you imagine? When you're baptized, all your sins are forgiven.
What kind of sins do you have as a newborn baby?
Exactly. But think about being a 25-year-old guy.
Well, there you go.
Baptized, and guess what? Boom, clean. Your soul is wiped clean. That's the power of the Holy Spirit of baptism. Okay? That's phenomenal. Am I upset over the fact that I was baptized as a baby? You're darn right I am. Now would be a really good time for me to get baptized.
Oh, you just go to confession then.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying. I'm trying to be a little bit facetious.
I got you.
But here's one other thing about St. Augustine that is absolutely fascinating to me, okay? His mom, St. Monica, notice, saint, prayed for his conversion every day. And she prayed to God that the one gift that she would request of God was that she would see her son convert back to faith before she died. And sure enough, she got that wish granted to her. So he did convert back to being a Catholic. And he did study very hard, and he did start to do these amazing writings. And ultimately, he was proclaimed a priest, and he became a bishop against his will. He did not want to be a bishop, but he was asked to be and eventually convinced that he should do it. And then he ended up spending the rest of his life really as a pastor out in the North part of Africa. He wrote many books that are very well still read today. One of his most famous is A City of God, which was really kind of a charge against the pagans and the whole fall of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like that they say it goes against the pagan belief that the fall of the Roman Empire was caused by Christianity, which it was not, of course. It was caused by many other things. So anyway, St. Augustine, fascinating character, very prolific writer, and one of the great doctors of the church. The one thing that I'd like to mention, which is a little-known fact, he is also the father of the autobiography.
He's the first person to document his own memoirs?
He's the first person that the body of writing included a book called Confessions. And that book was the story of his restless youth and his stormy spiritual voyage through life.
Oh.
And it was not really, it was supposed to be a book more of an exploration of the philosophical and emotional development of an individual. It wasn't meant to be his life story. It was just supposed to be a story about that important aspect of his life. Turns out that it broke fresh ground as literature, and the whole genre of autobiography started because of that book.
Folks, you are listening to the Catholic Cemeteries Association radio show, along with Chris Radlitz, the Director of Family Services of the CCA. I'm Gary Byron. That's a pretty fascinating
story
of redemption.
Guess what St. Augustine is the patron saint of? Brewers.
Brewers?
Brewers.
Oh, jeez. I know that St. Thomas Aquinas, though, he's another well-known doctor of the church, right? What was his contribution to the church?
Well, so like St. Augustine was the patron saint of brewers, St. Thomas Aquinas, who is also a priest and doctor of the church, is the patron of all universities and of all students. Okay. So here you have quite a dichotomy between two very learned people whose writings, I think, are almost on par with each other. Okay. But St. Thomas Aquinas, from a very, very young age, knew he wanted to be part of God's plan. He was a devout little Catholic kid to the point that his parents were worried about him, that he was way too devout, that he wanted to join the Order of St. Dominic. His family was deadly opposed against it. They started to do everything they could to try and undermine it. They resorted to all manner of means over a two-year period when he was 17, because they didn't want him to be locked away as some kind of a priest. They wanted him to be part of their family and in the world, etc., even though they were good Catholics. They just didn't get it, okay? It was so bad that they actually sent a woman to him to try and tempt him to do things. See, I mean, he was chaste all his life, okay? He was that devoted to God. As a matter of fact, he was granted the gift of God of perfect chastity. And they call him the angelic doctor because of the fact that he went throughout life with the only love that he needed was the love of God. And the only love he needed to give was love to God. So it was really amazing. He ultimately became a priest. Like I said, he made his professionals in Naples. Mm-hmm. He celebrated a lot of his learning under St. Albert the Great. He was nicknamed the Dumb Ox when he was in school, which is amazing. Because, A, he was a huge guy. St. Thomas Aquinas is bigger than me. And I'm 6'4", and, you know, 280. Well, not anymore. No, 255. Thank you now. Very much. So he was a big guy, and they used to call him a dumb ox, but the fact is he was a brilliant student. And at the age of 22, he was appointed to actually teach at that same university. So, and then he became a priest 4 years later after he was sent to Paris. So it was an amazing thing. But one of his greatest books was something called Summa Theologica, okay? Mm-hmm. It is one of his most well-known works, and it is one of the books that the reason it was so important, the reason that it got such influence was he believed it was really important for people, or especially for students, to understand the faith for beginners, not people who already were proficient in the faith. Mm-hmm. Like so many priests, well, I shouldn't say that. There's a lot of books and teaching out there that support those who are already part of the faith, that support those who understand the faith, and this just builds on it. But then there's all those that are Catholic who don't really understand their faith, who don't really know their faith. Summa Theologica was one of those books that was a perfect instructional guide for beginners in the faith. And it's still to this day being read everywhere and taught in universities. Okay, it is an amazing book, actually. So he was truly ended up being one of the most greatest and most influential theologians of all time. And he was canonized in 1323 and declared Doctor of the Church by Pope Pius V.
Wow. What a story that is.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. But again, look at the dichotomy between St. Augustine
and
this guy. He was holy from the day one, and the other guy was debaucher.
And I know we've got less than 5 minutes remaining. Oh. Really quickly, you mentioned something a little while ago when we were talking, I think, about the doctors of the church and as St. Thomas Aquinas was. But you had mentioned, I think, there were four women, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Could I just get something out of you that I should have asked you this earlier, but it just dawned on me now, especially in reference to the doctors of the church. I think there was one of the first women that was designated as a doctor of the church, I believe, was Catherine of Siena.
St. Catherine of Siena, yeah.
Okay. Was it 1970 by Pope Paul VI?
Well, I...
Or do I have that...
When she was canonized, you mean?
Yeah. Do I have that wrong, or...
It was Pope Paul VI that, I think, declared her a doctor of the church. I don't think it was... I think she was declared a saint before. Or then.
Okay.
But well, I don't remember exactly.
I'm not known for having all of... That's why you're here, my friend. That's why it's...
Yeah.
That's why it's your show and not mine.
And you're asking me a question that I don't know the answer to when it comes to St. Catherine of Siena, which
but
I wish
can
I
you
did.
Tell me, maybe, I don't know, 3 minutes or maybe even a little less. A little bit about her life and her contribution.
Here's the interesting thing. She was the 25th child born to her mother.
Wow. 25th?
Let me say that again. The 25th child born to her mother. Now, this was... You know, early days, 1347 is what we're talking about. So this is a long time ago, okay?
Whew.
Over half of her brothers and sisters died. They never did survive childhood because back in those days, plagues, everything else. She was born during the outbreak of the plague in Siena, Italy. Okay? That's why so many...
Was she the youngest or were there more
she was the youngest.
After her?
She was the 25th child. She was the youngest child. Can you imagine that?
No,
at the
I
age
can't.
Of 16, and at the age of 16, her sister, Bonaventura, died. Leaving her husband as a widower. Now, check that out. At the age of 16, Catherine's parents proposed that he marry his sister's husband. That she marry his sister's husband.
Oh, okay.
But Catherine was like dead set against it.
I misheard that.
So even at 16, she was like, no, that's not what I want to do. So she began fasting, and she cut her hair really short so as to be unattractive.
Unattractive.
Okay? And her parents kept pushing her, and she kept resisting this move, did not want to get married. And so ultimately, they were unsuccessful. So her fasting and her devotion to her family convinced them finally to relent and just allow her to live her life as she pleased. And she once explained that she regarded her father as a representation of Jesus and her mother as a representation of Our Lady. and her brothers and sisters as apostles, mm-hmm. which helped her to serve in humility. So despite that religious nature, she did not enter into a convent, even though you would think that's what she was heading. Instead, she joined the Third Order of St. Dominic, which allowed her to be a part of a religious society and still live at home and have a lot of interaction with people, you know, general people. The fellow Dominican sisters taught St. Catherine how to read. She wasn't that terribly well-schooled. She lived quietly, isolated with her family at home.
Oh.
When she was 21, she described a miracle that was called her mystical marriage to Christ. And that completely changed her life even more so, where she felt that Christ himself had given her a ring, and that was the ring that she wore, and that was the beginning of her real growth and deep love of the Catholic faith in Christ. She allegedly had the stigmata later in life, which is the visible wounds of Christ that he had on the cross, meaning the hands mm-hmm. and the
oh my
nails
goodness.
And the feet.
Eerie.
Yeah, it is weird. It is eerie. And we had a woman in Danbury, actually, years ago that actually proven had the stigmata. But anyway, so she was, in 1377, she actually established a monastery for women, which was outside of Siena. And by the age of 33, she became ill and she died.
Oh, sad story.
Which is a sad story. Yeah. But nonetheless, fascinating woman.
Another sad part of this story is that we are just about at the end of our time here. Folks, if you've got questions regarding the Catholic funeral plan, or anything pertaining to the Catholic Cemeteries Association, I urge you to check out their website, www.ccacem.org. Again, it's ccacem.org. You can also call their toll-free phone number. It's 800-505-0080. Once again, toll-free 800-505-0080. You can also send an email. Maybe we can get your question answered on these very airwaves here. ccawdrc@gmail.com. For Chris Radlitz, the Director of Family Services over at the Catholic Cemeteries Association, I'm Gary Byron. Until next Saturday, have a good one, everybody. So long.